Welcome to this episode of No One Gets Out Alive, your only podcast for detailed breakdowns of the George Lopez Show, episode by episode. I am one of your hosts, Kyle. I'm normally joined by my co-host, Tim, which is unfortunate because normally we set out to talk about the George Lopez Show, but every episode we're interrupted in our schedule to do interviews, but actually set time aside this time to do one with Tim, and he couldn't make it tonight. So unfortunately, we're not going to be able to talk about the episode where it's Halloween and all the workers are worried about the plane crash. So an inspector from the NTSB comes to the factory and interviews George and then shuts down the factory. All the workers are worried about losing their jobs, so George turns the house into a haunted tomb to take their minds off it. We actually have a really good episode. I am super excited about this one. One of my favorite books of 2020. I keep forgetting it's 2021 already. But very excited to be talking to Lee Harlan about Blood Like Garnet. How are you doing, Lee?
I'm doing pretty good. It's getting cold here now.
Yeah, it was good. Yeah, it's snowing. We've had like the last couple weeks where they predict snowstorms and it's just like a mild annoying snow all day, but
yeah,
you guys because it's snow in Seattle. I know it rains a bunch.
It does. You know, I grew up in Michigan, so I hardly counted as yeah. Snow, but it's really hilly, so it gets really icy and nobody knows how to deal with it, so it is kind of a mess.
Yeah, that's, I remember one Christmas I went with my dad. We went to Albuquerque, New Mexico, and a family friend out there, and we went like the week of Christmas, and it, like, I think maybe there was like a light dusting of snow, and like people were like freaking out and like pulling their cars over. It's like, what's going on? Like, this is, it's like, yep, a morning dew.
Well, when you're surrounded with people who don't know how to drive in it and don't have the right tires for it and nobody knows how to actually get rid of it, it can be a whole thing.
Yeah. Well, even here, I think it's like every year November hits and people are like surprised that we live, yeah, in the Northeast. But we did a best of this year episode, and we were talking about a bunch of stuff. TKO's one of my favorite publishers, and one of the major reasons was this year kind of them branching out into prose, and not only that, horror prose, which is easily my favorite. How did that come about? I know, familiar with you from some of your anthology work. You didn't do the radio one. You did that film.
I did, yes. The Lost Films.
Lost Films, yes. That was so good. So how did this come about? Like, how does a comic publisher branch into awesome anthology?
You know, I honestly don't really know what their own thought process was in contacting me, but it's funny that you mentioned Lost Films, because it was actually that story that one of their editors, Sebastian, had listened to when it got republished in the podcast Pseudopod.
Oh, right.
Yeah, and he really liked it, so he reached out to me to look into maybe doing a short story with me, which we wrote, and, you know, I think everybody had a good time. He and I worked together really well on editing the project, so it kind of grew into a whole collection from there.
I've enjoyed that they've kind of you know, branched out. They've done a lot of, they did the shorts. Sebastian did one. Mm-hmm. We did an episode with the Night Train, which, like, with a 5-month-old at home, that is like the scariest story I've ever read. Is there times, did you read that one?
I did, yes.
Yeah, yes. There's numerous times where you're like, I've said it before, and it's terrible. Like, but, like, I get why people shake their babies. Like, that's horrible to say. Like, obviously you wouldn't want to do it, but just like the frustration, and Steve was able to capture that. And, mm-hmm, again, kind of so impressed with this book. And I mean, your stuff has been great, but this was just like every story in it was like perfect. And I was like, oh, this is going to be the best one in it. I don't know why I should put that in the middle. And I was like, oh, this one's fucking great. When approaching this, was it like you had one story and then like it kind of, you guys had developed it more, and then were you able to fill it out? Were you sitting on any of these stories, or are these all kind of fresh in your mind?
These were all brand new for this. Actually, the first one we worked on together was Karaoke, which I think ends the book. And that was a concept that they came to me with that I wrote based on kind of their vague idea of there being a karaoke bar where somebody starts seeing like past betrayals on the screens behind them. And then, yeah, from there, kind of things just... They passed me a few ideas. Some of them were mine. And I just wanted to make it so that, you know, if you like horror, there's probably something in there that you would like. So I tried to keep everything kind of different feeling.
Well, I think that's one of the most interesting things about the collection is a lot of them seem to, and I don't know if that is, maybe you can talk to this, like, I don't know if that is like them coming to you with kind of ideas, but I like that a lot of it feels like it kind of hits, they all kind of hit the maybe familiar beats of horror. Like, you know, there's, I don't want to spoil anything for anyone that's read it, because again, they're fairly, like, I think it's like 165 pages. It's so nice to just sit down and read it. But, like, they all kind of hit, like, you know, there's like a found footage, like maybe, you know, outbreak type thing. There's, you know, the karaoke one, there's kind of a twist on a serial killer. And they, as you're reading them, like, if you're fairly familiar or kind of in aware of horror, I think you can kind of, like, catch on to, like the, I like that it doesn't rely on, like, twists. Like, you kind of show what is going on. And, like, as a reader, especially, like, I can think of, like, the found footage one. What is, that's the one with the, like, Latin name. That I'm not
yeah, the sure. The Lazarus taxon.
Yeah. Like, so, like, early on, you can, I'm like, oh, I can kind of see where this is going. But, like, you are able to kind of then, like, weave it with such an interesting either narrative or hook, or the characters are so engaging that, like, this is something I'm really about. Like, I like twists, obviously, and I think a lot of short fiction works on that. But, like, mm-hmm. if the journey isn't, you know, good, then, like, I mean, you know, a twist might make the story interesting, but it doesn't necessarily make it a good story. And I think you do an amazing job of kind of either, if it's something where it's, you know, kind of following a familiar horror trope, you really just kind of either lace it with an interesting detail, or you just make it, like, so engaging that it, like, the ride is just extremely fun to go on. Which, again, I think is difficult to do in short horror if you're not just, like, relying on a twist.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate you saying that. Yeah, so one of the great things about doing a collection like that was that, yeah, I got to play around with more familiar tropes. When you're subbing to magazines and, you know, you're one of 1,500 people in a slush pile, and you're writing, you know, about spooky bats or whatever, you know, that ended up in this, is there's a bunch of people doing that, so they're not necessarily even going to look at it. But I do think there's a lot of interesting ground to cover still, though, in a lot of those tropes.
Right, because I think, well, even, like, the karaoke one, I think the most interesting thing about that one, again, like, that's, it is a cool idea, and, like, that whole idea and the kind of horror and the tension that builds out of it is fantastic. But the really fun thing about that one is written in a style where it's like attacking you, in the sense you are writing towards the reader, so, like, you just, like, ultimately feel engaged by you doing that. And the title one, Blood Like Garnets, I like because it focuses on the serial killer character, and he addresses it in first person, but then there are, like, paragraphs where you pull back and kind of look at the quote-unquote victim. And that's in, like, a third-person narrative. And, like, but you're getting different viewpoints. Like, you play with viewpoints, like, so well in this one. Like, there's so many different ones. Obviously, the found footage one is a kind of a first-person narrative. So I think that's what's really interesting as well, because, like, you were able to kind of adjust the settings and really kind of bring people in, again, versus just kind of, like, a very standard anthology approach. And I imagine having, like, 160 pages to explore those things was beneficial on your end.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, thank you. I do really think that both, like, first person and second person, as well as unreliable perspectives, are both really enjoyable and really effective, particularly in horror.
Yeah, especially because, you know, movies we see it a lot, especially kind of found footage is a way you can really, you know, bring a person into it. But like with horror, there's a lot of I think different ways you can approach it, and something we talk a lot about, we end up covering a lot of horror comics on here because it's mine and Tim's kind of favorite genre. I think comics in itself is a very hard medium to get horror to work, because you're like with prose, like what you do, you can really kind of play with the imagination and allow the reader kind of expand upon it themselves. In film, you have like music cues and you have cuts and all that stuff, and then in comics, I think there's like a lot of instances where the reader has a lot of control, so I think there's like kind of a lot of space you have to explore in comics. But ultimately as well, I think in the prose you can play with it a lot more, and I think you do that well. Is that something you've kind of always had with your approach to horror? I think, is there something that kind of has stood out for you the way you've wanted to attack it in general?
Yeah, I think the thing that I love about writing horror for myself is kind of all those different perspectives that are not always the focus of the genre. You know, you don't always hear from the monster unless they're going to be the sympathetic anti-hero. And you don't always hear from that person who gets killed at the very beginning. So I do like playing around with perspectives in horror, and I think it can give a very different feel to some of those stories.
Yeah, I think going back to the Blood Like Garnets, I love that. Again, there was... someone for you, I think, who has worked a lot in the anthology, and there's an interesting, I think, parallel between comics and horror novels. I think so many people kind of either start in those anthology worlds or are writing shorter fiction and then kind of building out into larger things. I think we're seeing that now with comics, especially with like Kickstarters and a lot of the anthologies or shorts or webcomics. People are kind of cutting their teeth on that, which... like being able to write a short fiction, I think, is harder than writing a longer fiction. Is that something? Have you become comfortable in that, or is there something where have looked to longer fiction? Do you think that would change your approach to horror?
Yeah, they are definitely very different skills, and yeah, I do think a lot of people, you know, they start writing short fiction so that they can make it to that next stepping stone of novels or whatever, which is great. I mean, you do learn a lot of things. You learn how to be more concise. You learn how to set a scene really well. And I think those are important skills to take with you. But they are definitely completely different in terms of how you're going to set the pacing, how you're going to frame your characters. But I have done some longer stuff too. I have a novella that came out this past year too, which is extremely different from Blood Like Garnets. And then I have a couple novellas coming out this year as well, hopefully COVID madness permitting.
Oh, I know. Oh, is it is Queens of Noise?
Yes, yeah.
Oh my god, yeah, I have that. I actually just ordered that today.
Awesome. I hope you like it. It is very, very different.
I'm excited. Yeah. I think we normally are kind of aware of the timeline for comics, and part of the podcast was always exploring the idea of the amount of work and effort that goes into kind of making things and kind of appreciating that, whether you enjoy the output or not. Like I was doing reviews for a long time, and I was always annoyed of doing reviews because, like, even if I didn't like something, I could figure out why this wasn't for me and it might be for someone else. And it's like, for you, like what was kind of the timeline with them coming to you with that and then releasing it and getting it out? Obviously you kind of hit before COVID, so that was good, but like what was kind of the, like, how long does this take you to do that, especially kind of working with TK, who is kind of new to the longer form stuff?
Mm-hmm. Oh man, when did I want to say I started working with them about a year. Yeah, I think we worked on this book for about the better part of a year anyway. The actual publishing, once it was actually written, was for me as somebody who's been in prose, was so fast on their end. I'm used to, you know, we finish this book, it's going to be out in a year and a half or something like that.
Yeah.
But after we actually did the, you know, finished up the writing and the editing, it was actually only a few months after that that they put the book out. But the actual creation of it took about a year.
Oh, man. I mean, obviously, I think that is impressive on both ends for all this to be. I felt like they're so, I think, well-developed in the sense of, again, of the things that I find interesting, either characters or kind of tone and mood. Like, it almost feels like ones you were sitting on, but to find out you kind of just wrote, not, I don't want to say just wrote them as that, like, means, like, I don't know if that sounds to me. Like, you were able to kind of develop them and then put them out. But then the publishing side is interesting as well, because we cover a lot of, I've been really interested in the, like, young adult comics, especially because, like, they do an amazing job with kind of, with horror books for, like, the young adult scene. And those, like, sometimes you'll finish them and they'll sit on them, like, Scholastic will sit on them for, like, a year and a half for whatever reason. I don't know how their publishing end works. But, for TKO to kind of be able to put that out and obviously put it out in a really nice collection, obviously amazing art from Maria Gwynn. Yes. Was that something you were aware of going in? Was you kind of just giving her, like, little ideas of what the stories were?
Yeah, you know, she actually did all of that after the book was written. Nice. They passed the stories on to her, and she just kind of did her magic. And the art is incredible. I was so thrilled when I started seeing sketches.
Yeah, and they really... Obviously, each story has one image, but it does a lot to kind of add to the... the mood of it. The this house is not haunted one.
Yeah.
Oh my god, that image, that story. I'm jumping on. I'm terrible at these because I get so excited. And I'm like, I just like talking about. Is there one that kind of has stood out to you as your favorite as you read it? I wouldn't say that because I brought that up, and that one is like stuck with me because I don't know if we've gotten. I can't think of a time where we've gotten the perspective of the haunted house, and I think that's a spoiler because that's not necessarily what the story is about, like the long story, but like I always thought that was genius. Is there one that has stood out to you as kind of your favorite as you've developed them?
I think it's hard because given it various times I've liked them all as my favorite, but probably Sugar and Spice and The New Flesh I think are my two favorites.
Yeah. Sugar and Spice is again, another one where I think you're able to kind of, this seems like the longest one, and...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that one is a novelette, actually, so it is a little longer.
And you do, again, kind of, you play with expectations. I think when that one, again, not spoiling, like, the premise of it, her waking up in a school, and everything is a little bit off, like, just the horror of her waking up there, like, was, like, unsettling, and then it just kind of like moves past that, and I was like, oh shit, and we're like moving into the next one, and that one you again kind of, I was like, early on I was like, oh, I've seen Invasion of the Body Snatchers type thing, and I was like, but the like twist among that, and again the attachment you get to them and JJ, and like it's just like being able to establish that in such a short time is so important, because the payoff is more there. Like if you're not able to do that, and again, and harp on, like if you're just relying on twists, like it doesn't necessarily sit with you as well. And all these ones I think are really good because they sit with you. You know, there's a lot of times where I read them and I was like, oh shit, like that was a cool twist. But like outside of that, I'm like, okay, like you don't move. But like really kind of getting people invested in the characters is, I think, important, because then, again, that's one where it sits with you, and I'm thinking about it the next day, and I was like, and the haunted house one was, for whatever reason, was so uncomfortable to me.
That one was actually partially inspired by a trip to a museum in Dublin where they had the bog mummies.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The house we live in right now, we had built, and that was like my I've lived in apartments all my life growing up. And when my wife wanted a house, I was like, I don't know. But I was like, well, I'll live in a house if we build. I don't even believe in ghosts. It's like one of those things where I don't believe in ghosts. Like, just logically, kind of based on where, you know, I don't, you know, believe in religion or anything like that. I'm like, I don't know what there would be an afterlife of. But I also don't want to take any chances. Like, I don't want to put myself in a situation where I could be a ghost, even though I don't believe in them. So it's like, I don't want to live in a house where someone was murdered. So we live in a house we built, which I was like, perfect. But we live right by the battlegrounds in Saratoga. So it's like, there's got to be like tons of dead bodies under us. Like, yeah. So now I'm in a poltergeist situation.
So if there are ghosts, they're definitely there.
Yeah. But they're probably like British, like old timey ghosts. So I don't know. Hopefully
they'll just bring you a cup of tea.
Exactly. The British, they just wanted housing. Like, when you, like, they would come through and they would require, like, the colony people. So, yeah, like, you can have a spare room. I think something I've covered a lot this year, one of my favorite things last year was the Lolo Woods with Carmen Machado. So she put that out through DC. It's like, I think, one of the most amazing horror comics. And again, kind of the ability of horror, which is something I've always enjoyed, where it's kind of able to, as a, you know, a straight white male, not necessarily understand the perspective of a teenager kind of struggling with, you know, in that one, it's like this town where the kind of the women are oppressed and they kind of lose their memories and they can't figure it out. And the main protagonist is queer, she's in a relationship. And like, I love horror because it puts you in a realm where you can kind of empathize with characters and get an understanding, because I can relate with being scared.
Right.
And so because of that, I'm then able to like kind of empathize further with these characters that I wouldn't necessarily like feel that I was on the level of being able to empathize with, because like, I don't want to put myself in their situation. That's not my story. But I love that horror can do that. And obviously, like, you've talked about this a lot, being kind of like a queer writer and doing that. Like, is that something for you? And we see this a lot now with either people of color or women are really like killing it in horror. Even this year, like Stephen Graham Jones, The Only Good Indians, again, that's kind of a person of color approaching it. What is it to you that like not only appeals to you with horror, but allows like you kind of to approach those more kind of diverse storytelling aspects and really kind of make them effective with horror?
You know, I think as being somebody who is marginalized, day-to-day life can involve a lot of fear, or at least a lot of alienation. And so I think people who do inhabit those margins sometimes have a very acute sense of what that fear feels like. And writing it can be really cathartic then.
Yeah, I think it's such a great way, again, to kind of, at least as a reader, I like it. It's such an effective way to get them in it, because everyone is like, if you look at it, everyone is hopefully the same on the base level. Like, obviously there's horrible people, but because they don't seem to understand that, again, everyone is the same, fears, hopes, dreams, all that stuff. And like, horror really strips that down and allows you to kind of, again, empathize with that. Like, I have in front of me in all the names. It's the punk rock one in this. Was that? Oh, Where the Body Ends. I love that one because, like, again, it's like I think the character's like late 30s. Ostensibly, it seems to be like kind of non-binary in that sense, where like, I like that. There's talking about the woman, but also the attractions to the guy, and like, and then kind of being an older punk in this like young punk world, and like really like kind of this like deep narrative, but then attaching it through this like this haunting, like almost like Lovecraftian, like horror music. It's like, again, a really like, it's so such a good way to kind of like just invest yourself in a character that you aren't otherwise. You know, I mean, I empathize with, unfortunately, being an older person at hardcore shows where I'm just like. Like, oh, I don't want to sit for
that. Sebastian said the same thing, too. I think that was one of his favorites for exactly that reason.
Yeah, I read it, and I was like, oh, God. Like, because, I mean, if you know, it's not something that's going on. But, like, the last time I went, I was like, I'll just sit in the back. Like, I don't want to be, I don't want to be hurt. It's like, does it have to be so loud? Why are we so loud, guys?
Yeah, yeah. Well, let the kids throw themselves around. Yeah.
It's like, well, I could just watch this on YouTube on my phone. I don't know what we're doing here.
My feet hurt.
For you, is it something, again, the interest of kind of TKO being there? And again, I think, again, recently comics have been kind of a good medium for horror. Is that something working with them that... has that, like, piqued your interest at all in that kind of, that realm?
A little bit. You know, I think at my heart, I am a prose writer. But I do think that, teaser, you may see some things with me and TKO again in the future.
Nice. Do you, and this is, I think, just a broader thing versus, again, I'm always interested in someone coming from prose, do you see kind of the difference, or like, even if you were to attempt to write, like, would your approach change going into comics where, again, you kind of have those more static visuals? Is there something about your style, which is, again, very character and, I think, atmospheric driven, that would change to approach that? Or do you think that would kind of adjust easily for you?
You know, I think as somebody who relies a bit on, I write a lot of dialogue and I write a lot of scene setting, that would be kind of tough for me in comics because I would just want to fill up all of the page, and you can't do that. You gotta trust your artist more than that.
Right. Well, I mean, yeah, you could go the Alan Moore style. You could just write a book with a few pictures.
Yeah.
Is that something as well? I think you do. You tackle well. And a lot of people have been kind of adjusting to it. And I think we've seen really interesting ideas of tech and horror and kind of how people are going to tackle that. Friend Phone being a really interesting one. But even all of them kind of hint on the kind of, I don't want to say new age, but like the new style of horror where that's something you have to adjust to. Everyone has phones. Everyone kind of has those things. And obviously, the trope of, oh, I have no service here. I think people have kind of been able to get around that. Again, the karaoke one, I think, is a really smart thing. Is that something you seem to adjust more? Is that, at this point, kind of, you know, us growing up with it, is it something you're comfortable with just attacking with horror?
You know, yeah. I mean, I'm a little bit of an older millennial, but I did grew up with the internet, and at least most of my young adulthood had a cell phone. So having those things be part of the world that either you have to include actively or find a way to have them not short-circuit your plot in the first paragraph. I think that is something that I think about pretty naturally.
Are you, for your writing style, are you consuming a lot while you read? A lot of the horror writers we talked to, I think, especially recently, kind of, I think, like, more so with horror, because of you really want to establish the tone. I think people are working with mood boards, stuff like that. Is there something do you throw yourself into anything when you're writing, or is it the opposite? Are you kind of detached when you're writing to kind of not, I think, bring things in that you wouldn't otherwise want to bring in subconsciously?
You know, I usually, when I am writing horror, I am usually mostly reading horror, because I do find that what I'm reading influences what I'm writing. And if I'm reading, like, stuff that's, you know, more lighthearted comedic kind of things, then I find myself starting to write that, and then the tone gets all weird in my own writing. Otherwise, I listen to a lot of music. I usually have a dedicated playlist for my projects.
Oh, what were some of the ones for Blood Like Garnets?
So I listened to the Pan's Labyrinth soundtrack a lot for that one, actually.
Nice. That, I think additionally, is that something, with horror being, I think, one of the more difficult things to capture effectively, I think also with humor, do you feel comfortable as someone who's kind of now focused so much on writing, do you feel like being able to do horror, you could tackle most genres?
So I've definitely written in science fiction and fantasy. Queens of Noise has a romance plot, but ultimately I think is more of a urban fantasy style thing. I think I'm mostly comfortable in those speculative genres, though. Like, I don't think you're gonna see my name in the lit fic or the straight up romance aisle as much as I may admire those particular writers. It's just not in my wheelhouse.
Although I will say, so on, and I always hate bringing it up because if there's people who listen to the show regularly, like a million times, but it being an interview show, every episode, this is a different person I'm talking to, but so like on the weekends, I have a 9-to-5, but on the weekends I work at Barnes & Noble for their discount because they give you 40% off books, which is fucking awesome. But So the romance section is like one of my favorite because like it's either like cowboy romance or like horror romance. Like, and it's such a weird because the mix of women you see go in that aisle and that I help, like, I'm always surprised that there's so many women that read kind of that, like, you know, he's a vampire or it's a werewolf. There's a lot of werewolf ones. I'm not sure why, but like, I don't know if they would classify themselves as like horror readers. And I've talked to a bunch of them, like, cause I'll be like, you know, you should check out this, you know, this other story. And they're like, I don't really read that. I'm like, I think you do. Like, I think this is horror. Like, I think if you like werewolf, it's like, it's body horror, but, it's so weird. There's like that kind of crossover with it, and I think we see that a lot with young adults as well. Like that's a huge genre, especially with fantasy. There's like such a big crossover,
right? And I think it goes the other way a little bit too. You know, like a lot of speculative fiction readers would definitely walk past the romance aisle, but if you told them it was a book about like werewolf politics, they might pick it up.
Right. Well, it's. I was watching an interview with Christopher Paloma. He wrote The Aragon, and he recently wrote To Sleep in a Sea of Stars. So I picked that up, and I don't know, I was watching an interview with him, and he was saying how, like, you know, at this point in his career, people have kind of tagged him as, like, a fantasy writer. But he was like, you know, for me, that's awesome because the idea of being someone who writes within fantasy or within horrors, like you at that point, like that's those two are kind of like genres that encompass anything. So you could write a love story set in a sci-fi world. You could write a like in-depth political, I mean, like if you look at The Phantom Menace, like that's just a political drama set in a sci-fi world. And like those two kind of horror and I think sci-fi specifically are ones like you could literally throw in anything and like put them those two in those kind of like genres and they work. Like I think horror and sci-fi are like just like blankets around a thing versus like the actual kind of specifics of the genre.
Yeah, absolutely. Like the whole genre dividing lines are this whole weird thing of like what is a story element and what is a genre and which one does it belong to it's a whole thing.
Right. Yeah, and then I mean there's like you could look at Dan Simmons writes like historical, like that's the most historical books ever, but The Terror is like a scary as fuck book, but it's like about this like boring ass like British boat that gets stuck and then there happens to be a monster. For you as someone, I think one of the interesting things about your story and a few interviews, you talk about kind of being outside of writing for a long time. Working to become a lawyer and that really not being something you want to do and coming back to writing. What was that like as someone who works in like nonprofit and it's like, there's always the idea of like, this is what you do, going to do some, like, I come home and do this silly podcast, like, but it's like kind of an escape. What was that like for you kind of breaking from that and going back to writing? Was that scary? And like, how long did it take for you to kind of feel comfortable just like being a writer versus being someone who was like wanting to try writing and coming back to it?
Right. You know, it was a very gradual thing, you know, like I started trying to blow off steam in law school by starting to write, and wrote an extraordinarily horribly derivative vampire novel that will never see the light of day. And then, you know, I moved and started doing some short fiction that started getting published, which kind of, each time something got published, it was a little more like, you know, maybe I can actually invest real time in this, that it's not just when I have 5 minutes and I could actually maybe go about learning some more craft things so I can be better at it and that kind of thing. Now, you know, I have the day job at a nonprofit, but I do dedicate a lot of my out of office work and more than a few of my lunch breaks and slow days to writing.
Yes, that's the, yeah, the major appeal of nonprofit is I'm like, well, I can do a lot of that stuff. Yeah, that and not making any money is,
yeah, yep.
Feel. What were you going, what were you, did you have a specifics for law that you were focusing on?
I was actually interning doing nonprofit domestic violence focused, oh, nice, family law.
Oh, that's good. That's, yeah. Out of high school, I wanted to be a lawyer, and then mm-hmm. I did, so went to school for history because I was like, oh, you do that before pre-law, and that was gonna be a history teacher. But I wanted to do, like, I was like, it's gotta be like such a random, a niche. I was talking to people, I was like, I gotta just find like the most random, like I deal with like window law, and it's like, you gotta find that and then just like make your money in that and then just do whatever you want. But fortunately that is not the case. Yeah.
My heart just wasn't in the law that makes money. Weirdly, the subject I did the best at was trademark law, of all fucking things. Yeah, but there was no way I was going to pass myself off as a trademark lawyer with my mohawk and copious tattoos, so.
I know, yeah, that's, that will make it difficult. And that is another, the pro of nonprofit work. No one ever, like, yep, questions why I look like a bum.
Yep.
A lot of times people confuse me for clients that I case manage, where like there's definitely like clients who look way nicer than I do, and I'm,
yeah,
like,
when I was in a, I was representing a client at court, somebody's lawyer came up to me and asked me if I was her client for juvie court. It's like, well, thank you, and I'm offended, I guess, I don't know.
Exactly. It's so there was a time I was working as a, what do you call it? I worked in a day program with people with developmental disabilities, and I was one of the counselors that would take people out and kind of learn community-based skills. So I was out with these two people assisting them. We were volunteering at a food pantry, and I was there with another person, and we were overseeing kind of their job skills, and I was helping them. And so this was like run by through this church. So it was always these like old ladies who were there like running it. And this one woman kept coming over to me and being like, she's like, you're doing a really great job. I was like, oh, thanks. Like, that's very nice of you. Thanks. And then I dropped something at one point, and she like ran over. She's like, oh, don't worry about it. You're doing such a great job. You're doing great, buddy. And I was like, oh, thanks. Like, I was like, this lady's being so nice. And then she kept coming over and being like, wow, what do you like to do? And I was like, oh, when I go home, I like to play video games. And then the other staff comes over and was like, I'm about 100% sure she thinks you're someone with developmental disabilities. And I was like, oh, that's why she's treating me like I'm five. But at the same time, I was like, no one treats me this nice. And yeah, so apparently not that. But yeah, it is a one plus of nonprofit work. I use this often in the podcast for my own selfish reasons, whether it is when we're doing comics, if I can get like somebody pressing them on like a hardcover collection made, because I love physical media, but also horror. I think one of the best things is talking to you about, for some reason I sit on YouTube and watch like, what are they called, like booktubers or something, just talk about YouTube horror books. What are you reading or have been reading that you've enjoyed specifically with horror?
Let's see. I actually just literally started T. Kingfisher's The Hollow Place last night.
Oh, that's supposed to be, yeah. It's supposed to be really good.
Yes. I really liked the twisted ones. I've always liked T. Kingfisher / Ursula Vernon. She's always pretty delightful, but I've been really impressed with her foray into straight up horror.
Yeah, that's, I'm like, at least the booktube makes me feel good, because like I'll watch like someone's like, what do they call it, the TBR, like TB Red. They'll be like, oh, this month this is my TBR pile. And then I'll watch like their next month and it's like the same pile but with more books. I'm like, okay, like I definitely not. I just place an order for like six things on there, and I was like, I'm not gonna get to half those.
Yeah.
But
I'm very excited for Sarah Gailey's The Echo Wife coming out. That sounds horrifying and great.
And that's like naming the name, like specifically this like past year, Mexican Gothic. Was a Tender as the Flesh, obviously Blood Like Garnets. I'm trying to think, there was another one I read. I even just had ordered, oh, I'm not gonna bore why I looked through it, but I'm kind of like what we were talking about with either the different perspectives of it. But do you think that's the kind of bigger reason why I think like for a long time, and even now, I think more so, at least just being accepted, like women kind of being one of the biggest voices in horror. I mean, obviously, if you go back, which is silly, because like if you go back, obviously, like Shirley Jackson and Mary Shelley, like they're like some of the biggest names in horror. Do you think there's either anything with the society or something like that why we've kind of slowly turned the corner, hopefully, on the idea that like kind of women voices can either be the voice or kind of own horror?
Yeah. You know, I don't know, apart from just there are more women, people of color, queer and trans folks getting into positions of authority and power at publishing houses. I'm sure that has a lot to do it. You know, people tend to acquire books that appeal to them personally. And, you know, if you don't have any women or people of color there, odds are you're going to be picking the same books over and over again. So I do think that's probably playing a big part in why that's happening. And I also think that, you know, just pure capitalism, I think a lot of publishers have figured out that there are actually a lot of people who are not straight cis white dudes who really like horror. And it sells.
Yeah. Again, kind of like the things that have always kind of existed. Like if you look at the main consumers of like true crime media, it's women. It's like moms and stuff like that, because like they like, I mean, and I'm the same way. Like I like being afraid. I don't know if I like, but like I will check my door 6 times a night because I watch like a documentary on like a serial killer. Like that is, it's like fun. And like, I think it's like a thing. And like, that's for like been a long time. Like, I mean, that's all of Lifetime. Lifetime is like a whole network of like scaring women of how they're going to get murdered.
Yep.
So yeah, for it to be kind of like ignored for a long time is interesting.
And as fucked up as many of those characters were, those of us who grew up in the 80s grew up with a lot of horror movies that were fronted by women, as, like I said, fucked up as some of those sexual politics happened to be in those movies. So I do think a lot more women grew up seeing themselves as in horror as compared to, say, science fiction.
Yeah. And yeah, it's interesting that I... there's one series I will check in on. It's like a kill count type thing. And like the kill ratio for like horror movies is surprisingly like there's a majority of guys who die in horror movies. For again, whatever, there's the obviously the symbolism or like the kind of themes of it. But, it always been kind of a genre that tends toward women heroes or women protagonists.
Final girl trope.
Yeah Well, even I mentioned the newest loud annoying addition to our family. We were coming up with names, and so this one is Ripley. It's like that's the best character in
abso-fucking-lutely. Yeah,
and it's a name that like obviously is kind of we decided not to know what it was, so I was like, that's a name like whether it's a girl or a guy, it'd be fucking awesome. It's of course is a name I can't pronounce. Antok. It's by Jessica Leonard. It was one I just ordered. It was supposedly really good this year. But because I'll just keep gushing over how much I love this book. But for anyone that is kind of interested in either this or kind of again your larger broad work, like what's the best way they could find out about that stuff?
Probably my website or Twitter, both of which are, website is leeharlen.com and Twitter is at leeharlen, and that's Harlan, H-A-R-L-E-N. A lot of people want to spell it like Harlan Ellison.
All right. Yes, if you go, like I said, this easily one of my favorite things that came out this year. Had just reread it for this, and even knowing kind of the stories, it was nice to go back to them. Like they still hit extremely hard. And I think something like where this like exposing, so obviously there's like the people who are fans of the TKO comics and might pick this up. Like you have a huge amazing catalog of great stuff. Children of God, like check anything out Lee does, it's amazing. But I'm trying to think, I always forget where I have stuff. That's what Tim's usually here for, to remind me that I have to actually promote the show. We are on Twitter at pages_panels. If you go to anchor.fm /pages_panels, we're on there. I was just like, you don't stumble upon a comic book or like a process podcast. Like it's not like a movie podcast where you might tune in. I think if you're listening, you probably know where to find us. But the whole idea is hopefully you either read or go pick up Bloodlight Garnets. It's like it's an amazing. I feel bad for you, Lee, because Tim was not here to rein me in.
This was fun.
I really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
No problem. And next time, Tim will be back, and we'll get back to George Lopez. I promise him every time. But